Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the John LaMontagne Memorial Lecture. As many of you know, this lecture honors my dear friend and former colleague, Dr. John LaMontagne, who had served as my deputy director of NIAID from 1998 until his untimely death in 2004. John came to NIAID in 1976 as the Institute's first influenza program officer, and later he served for more than 10 years as the director of the NIAID Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases. Throughout his career, John worked with vision and unflagging determination to foster innovative research on infectious diseases. His leadership and contributions to a wide range of fields, from HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis to childhood vaccines, made him a true public health hero, and he continues to inspire me and to many of us today. John's widow, Elaine, is with us today. Elaine, thank you very much for helping us commemorate John's exceptional career. Our speaker this afternoon is someone who also has made extraordinary contributions to biomedical research on infectious diseases. Dr. Rino Rapuoli. A native of Siena, Italy, Dr. Rapuoli still resides there and is currently the global head of vaccine research for Novartis Vaccines and Diagnostics. Rino has spent his career developing vaccines, notably against pertussis and meningitis, among others. He is jointly responsible for engineering the carrier protein used in many conjugate vaccines and also is credited with launching the field of reverse vaccinology. Since the first recorded cases of human H5N1 infections, influenza infections in 1997, Rino has worked to develop a vaccine that could prevent a pandemic sparked by this strain of avian influenza. Clinical trials of Novartis's H5N1 vaccine employing the adjuvant MF59 are among the most promising now in development. Dr. Rapuoli also has a distinction of being a co-founder of a relatively new field of science. In 1996, a paper in Science that he and his colleagues co-authored coined the term cellular microbiology, in which they noted would formalize a marriage between cell biologists and microbiologists, and this union is proving to be a happy one and has given rise to a series of meetings of cellular microbiologists, the founding of a scientific journal, and the publication of two textbooks thus far. Rino received his undergraduate and doctorate degrees from the University of Siena. He did his postdoc training first with Dr. Emil Gottschalk at the Rockefeller and then with John Murphy at Harvard Medical School. He's the author of more than 300 peer-reviewed papers and a member of the editorial boards of a dozen journals. In 2005, Dr. Rapuoli was elected to the United States National Academy of Sciences. That same year, he received the gold medal by the President of the Italian Republic in recognition of his contributions to public health care. We have a treat today because Dr. Rapuoli will discuss with us how vaccines in the 21st century should be viewed and valued as a form of lifelong health insurance. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Rino Rapuoli.
So, thank you, Tony, and thank you all for being here today. It is indeed a great pleasure and a great honor to have the opportunity to give a lecture for John LaMontagne. I knew him for quite a while, and he was really, first of all, a friend and a person that anytime we come to the NIH and we'll meet at meetings, we'll spend time together and will teach me a lot of things about infectious diseases, the new trends, and how to do and plan new vaccines. And it's really a great honor to be here to be able to give this lecture for him. I took this opportunity to put forward a concept that I'm not sure how well we will come out. It's the first time I do it, but I think John deserves this kind of things. And the concept I'm trying to talk about today is how vaccines should be viewed in the 21st century. And in the all we know and all the way we describe vaccines derives from our experience in the 20th century. And probably that's very good, but is not enough, or is not good enough for the new vision. So I'll try to tell you why we should change the way we look and we describe vaccines. And also I'll try to tell you why, that the 21st century is becoming also, let's call the golden era of new, golden age of vaccines. It's a new renaissance that is coming out and a lot of new opportunities. So my talk will focus on these things, basically a little bit of review of the impact that they had on us, why there is a renaissance in vaccine innovation due to several technologies, recombinant DNA, conjugation, progress in immunology, genomics. We'll talk a little bit about safety, what safety of vaccines used to be and what is today, and how we're going to look at them in the future. So we'll start with the first point, the impact and the value of vaccines. And I'm going to start with the good news. The good news is that life expectancy is growing, and is growing beyond any expectations. Here in this graph, which was published in Nature this year, you will see the prediction of 1980 or 1990 and the new estimates. So basically, the any prediction which is made 10 years later is basically the new prediction says that we can live longer. And that's a fact. And this fact basically has two consequences, which can be viewed as bad or good. We don't know. One is society is aging. Some people see that as a negative. I see that as a positive. The other one is that, obviously, in this type of society, we need a new healthcare model. I think vaccines can play an important thing, an important role in both of these things. Let's look at the why life expectancy is increasing. There's been a paper published in the PNAS in, I think it was January 2006, that basically they went back and they looked at the population of four or five European countries between 1750 and 1900, when the average age expectancy went from 35 years to 50 years, and then continued. And they looked at all the possible variables and things, and their conclusion was that the increase in life expectancy was mostly due to the conquest of infectious diseases. Why is so? Well, two main reasons. One is easy and was known even before that paper, and basically they said if you have if you reduce infant mortality, the life expectancy will increase, and that's easy to understand. Two people, one dies 1 year of age, the other one is 71 years, the average life expectancy will be approximately 35 years. The other thing which is not expected was this path. That basically reducing the infectious diseases in early age, in childhood and in adolescence, basically reduces a number of inflammatory events that somehow preserve the immune system and the body in a way that when you get to elderly age, there is a reduced mortality. And this hypothesis now has been somehow confirmed by a number of different things. But basically, it is true that, I mean, it is believed that this path really plays an important role in the increased life expectancy of today. So that's what is published. And if you have any doubt that infectious disease have an impact on life expectancy, you just need to look at Africa and HIV. I mean, in Africa, like in the rest of the world, in the 60s, basically, the life expectancy started to go up, like in other places. And then HIV came And dramatically life expectancy went down to levels which were pre-1960s. So clearly, we do have a dramatic example in front of us that infectious diseases do play an important role in life expectancy. Another figure that is usually used to show that infectious diseases have an impact on life expectancy is this one. This one describes the growing of life expectancy in the United States from the beginning of the century, of the 20th century to the year 2000. And what it shows that basically life expectancy increased like all the other places. But what it also shows that a single infectious disease, the 1918 influenza pandemic, basically caused a decrease in life expectancy, which was absolutely dramatic. And this single event is the most important thing in this century. Now, in this century, not only the pandemic influenza occurred, but also there were two important events that we all know about that are supposed to be the most catastrophic things of the past century, which were World War I and World War II. Now, if you combine the decrease in life expectancy of World War II and World War I, you don't get even close to the decrease in life expectancy that you got from a single pandemic influenza, from an infectious disease. And I think that's the way we should look at these things. I mean, the relative value. When we think of a pandemic influenza, we should not think of just another thing which is out there. Something, we should think about something which is more dangerous than the combination of two world wars. And then I come from Siena in Italy, where if you travel there, you will find this wall, which is next to the cathedral. This wall was built in 1340s, and at that time, the people in Siena were rich and powerful. They wanted to build the largest cathedral in the world. And the 1948, the Black Death came, and that was the end of the economic power of the building the largest cathedral and everything. And this wall, which is out there, is what I call the largest monument to infectious diseases ever built. So basically, infectious diseases do have a huge impact on life expectancy, and probably a large portion of the life expectancy, the long life expectancy we have today, is due to the conquest of infectious diseases. And when we talk about that, vaccines have played a major role. This slide basically shows the impact in mortality of vaccination against all the other important medical interventions of the last 40, 50 years, including antibiotics. And clearly, the impact of vaccination is greater than any of the others. So that is an overview of what we know about the impact of vaccines and the fact that the conquering infectious diseases through vaccination and the other measures has basically put us in a position to be where we are today with life expectancy. So this is the effect of vaccines, their value. How do we make vaccines? Well, this slide I try to summarize what we know about making vaccines. And all the vaccines have been licensed so far. They've been made by basically following what John Robbins calls the three the basic principles of Pasteur. And the Pasteur basically said, if you want to make a vaccine, you need to do three things. You need to isolate, inactivate, and inject the microorganisms that causes the disease. Using these basic principles, basically three types of vaccines have been made. Killed vaccines, you virus, bacteria, you kill and inject. We have examples of that as the Salk polio vaccine. Today we make viral-like particles, our recombinant tools that basically mimic killed vaccines. Another category is live attenuated vaccines. Sabin oral polio is a typical example. Today we have live recombinant vectors that somehow mimic those, but they're still based on the same principle. And then we have subunit vaccines that initially were diphtheria and tetanus toxoid. Today we have recombinant conjugate vaccines that belong to the same category. But basically all the vaccines that we have today, they start from one, from those principles. They start from the microorganism. And using these basic principles, a number of vaccines have been developed, and we have seen that basically all these vaccines have done tremendous, have had a tremendous effectiveness, and basically have eliminated completely smallpox and poliomyelitis from our countries, and all the other diseases, they got 97% effectiveness against the disease. However, these vaccines, most of these vaccines were developed in the 20th century, and many of them were developed with pretty crude technologies. The consequence of that is that the way we usually see vaccines today is that basically these vaccines were often associated with sometimes real and important safety concerns. Typical examples were when I started probably doing vaccines were in the 80s were the old cell pertussis, part of DTP. All the problems in this country are linked to potential encephalopathy, all those kind of things, and groups moving against vaccines, dissatisfied parents together, moving because of this, all the side effects, some of which were real and some of which was never, has been disproved to be true about DPT. The other polio, the Serbian polio, we knew that in one case in every 3 million vaccinations, you will actually get disease from the immunization. We had measles high doses that increase mortality in females. We have rotavirus that basically increased the intersusception. We got the swine flu. We got BCG that caused disseminated BCG infection. We got smallpox that basically was very reactogenic, generalized vaccinia, encephalitis, myocarditis. Recently, in the last part of the 20th century, was intranasal influenza causing Bell palsy, and there have been lots of things associated with thimerosal, which have not been proven to be, actually have been disproven to be correct, but they are happening in the mind of people. So this is the vision that we have of vaccines. Vaccines are very effective, great health benefit, increase our life expectancy, all these things, but they carry risk. Well, that, from my point of view, is the vision of the 20th century. Because in the 21st century, all these things that were, in most of the cases, were real concerns have been discontinued. Those vaccines are not being used any longer. So this concept that there are real risks associated with vaccination, I think is old, is something that belongs to the last century and should not belong to this century. Now, so basically, if I want to make a conclusion of what I said so far, is basically I believe that infant vaccination played a major role in the conquest of infectious diseases and in increased life expectancy. And in the 20th century, vaccines were associated with risks and safety concerns. And many times, they were real. In the 21st century, I think most of the safety concerns have been the real ones, have been eliminated. The vaccine should not be seen like those things from which you can get disease. You don't get paralysis from the Salk vaccine, but you used to do that from the Sabin vaccine. So we should look at them as friendly tools, kind of life insurance that can work for all ages, that can prevent health and economic risk, like prevention of pandemic influenza, can prevent cancer, like we have good examples already, HPV, papillomavirus, and other things. We are working on Helicobacter pylori, other cancers can be prevented. If we prevent more diseases in childhood and adolescence. Probably we can maintain a longer effect, a more effective immune system. And we can continue to prevent the diseases we are already preventing with them. So this is the new vision I would like to have for vaccines. And the basically, if I look at my experience in vaccines, when I started doing vaccines was 1980. At that time, now I would like to call that age the dark age of vaccines. Vaccines were scientifically and economically unattractive, and the only way to develop vaccines was empiricism. And the problem was, at the end of the 70s, all the vaccines that could be developed with the technologies that were available at that time, which are basically the three principles of Pasteur, have been done. And the new ones were beyond the technologies available. Well, now I would consider today the golden age of vaccines, because through the convergence of technology, innovation, and opportunity, and when technology, I mean recombinant DNA, I mean the conjugation, I mean the genomics, new adjuvants. Basically, we've been able to do many more vaccines, and we have the science to move away from empiricism and to design the vaccines of the future. And design means making them effective, making them good, and safe. So we'll never design vaccines that will have the problems they used to have before. Now, I'll try to walk through my experience on how I move from the empiricism to the next level of design. And I will use that meningococcus as an example, because I spent last 20 years working on meningococcus. And I think it's a good example. It shows how new technologies allow you to move to new concepts and new things. For those that don't know, meningococcal disease is a dreadful disease. And basically, the terrible thing is that it gets children, neonates, young guys, and adolescents. And the typical terrible thing is that usually these kids are good, they are healthy, and then at some point they get kind of a headache, and few hours later they can be dying in the intensive care unit. So they're really terrible disease, and still 10-15% mortality, and there's nothing you can do against that mortality. And the only way you can prevent that is by vaccination. Now, early 1980s, there were already vaccines developed by Emil Gottschalk in the 60s, and they were made by capsular polysaccharide vaccines. And these were against different serotypes, and the serotypes that cause disease in meningococcus are A, B, C, Y, and W. The polysaccharide vaccines against A, C, Y, and W, we'll talk about B later, were already in use, already licensed. But they, like we know today, the polysaccharides are T-cell independent antigens. They do not work in infants, and they do not induce memory. So they were used only in militaries and in cases of outbreak, but they were not used in general use. In early 90s, shortly after the development of conjugate vaccines for Haemophilus influenza, I thought that basically we could develop conjugates for meningococcus. So the conjugate is very simple. You take the long chain of polysaccharide, which is made by many repeating units of sugars, and as we just said, this is a good vaccine, but unfortunately it doesn't work in infants, does not induce memory. But now if you link this polysaccharide to a protein like CRIM-197, which is a non-toxic mutant diphtheria toxin, and you make a covalent linkage like this, you get what we call conjugate vaccine, which is a protein and with polysaccharide chains linked to it. Then you test these two vaccines, this one and this one, in children. What you get is the polysaccharide, as expected, doesn't work, and the conjugate works beautifully. We got this data from meningococcus C and meningococcus A back in 93, I think. And with this data, we were able to convince David Salisbury in the United Kingdom to start a process to develop this vaccine to take care of the high incidence of meningococcus C disease in the United Kingdom. We got together with other two manufacturers in the year 2000 to license that vaccine in the United Kingdom, a conjugate for meningococcal C. And here is a graph that showed what happened. These are the weeks of the year. The winter is in the middle. And here are the cases in one of the cohorts which were vaccinated. This is the number of cases in red the year before vaccination. Cases started to go high, the peak in the winter, they continued for the entire year. This is a year later, when we started vaccination at this point, cases were even higher than the previous year. We started vaccination, the curve somehow plateaus. And this is a year later. The disease was gone, and it's still gone. This is one of the most impressive slides I ever had. You got a disease, was there the year before, and was gone a year later, and never comes back. To give you an idea, here we vaccinated within a year every single person in the United Kingdom from 2 months of age to 20 years of age. And the disease was gone, and it's still there. Now this vaccine is licensed in many places, and that story repeats every time. So this is a result obtained with the conjugate vaccines, and we know conjugate vaccines are probably the safest vaccines we ever had. I mean, really never had any problem with conjugate vaccines so far. And so this is the way today, basically we, in addition to conjugates for meningococcal C, we have conjugates to meningococcal A, Y, and W, and so we have just finished phase 3 trial with a vaccine that will work in infants and that will cover 4 of the 5 serotypes of meningococcus. The problem with meningococcus is serotype B. Serotype B has also a capsule polysaccharide, but the capsule polysaccharide is linked is a polymer, which is a polysialic acid linked alpha 2-8, which is identical in structure to a polysaccharide, which is polysialic acid, which is built in our glycoproteins, typical as NCAM. As a consequence, the capsule polysaccharide of meningococcus B is a self-antigen, and our immune system does not recognize as a foreign antigen. Therefore, we cannot use conjugation. In the absence of conjugation, there have been many attempts to solve the problem in meningococcus B through development protein-based vaccines. The best of those attempts in the last 40 or 50 years is to get these outer-membrane vesicles, which are basically obtained by treating the bacteria with detergent. And you get these vesicles that can purify, and then basically they contain more or less 70 proteins. And one is immunodominant, and the immunity you get is against that serotype, well, against that particular protein. And there are many proteins of different types worldwide. But we got a problem in New Zealand. In New Zealand, they had, since the 1990s, they had an epidemic of meningococcus B. That epidemic was caused mainly by one strain, and therefore it was possible to use this outer membrane vesicle prepared from that strain to basically vaccinate the population in New Zealand. We were just fresh from the UK experience, so we went to New Zealand and convinced them to collaborate with us and develop and vaccinate a vaccine and develop a vaccine that could be used for the entire population in New Zealand. So we did that, and we started in the year 2000. By 2004, we were ready. We had done phase 1, phase 2, and large safety for a kind of pre-phase 3. And the vaccine was licensed. And this is what happened. Basically, we started to vaccinate the same thing as in the UK, all population from 2 months of age to 18 years of age, starting from the darker areas, which are the areas with highest incidence, and then we moved to the rest of the country. Again, we started 2004, we started vaccination, these are the previous years. In a year, the disease from these areas was gone. Now the disease and the epidemic has gone from the entire country. So much they decided to stop vaccination, something I do not agree with, but that's the public policy. And basically, this was a true demonstration that you could develop a vaccine also against meningococcus B. Unfortunately, this vaccine was against the New Zealand strain. If we brought that to Europe or US, we'll cover only a fraction of the strains, so it will not be a good one. So the problem of developing a vaccine for meningococcus B was still there. And going back to the middle 90s, I was trying to work my own way to make a vaccine for meningococcus B. But I tried making conjugates that people thought at that time could be made. I tried to use proteins. I tried to use OMVs. I got to the conclusion that with the technologies we had in the middle 90s, meningococcus B was beyond reach of what we could do at that time. I thought that was the case so much that I discontinued the project. I said, I don't want to work on something that I know is I'm not going to make. So I don't know what you do here in Bethesda or in Washington when you get run out of ideas. I do live in Siena. Well, and in Siena there is a nice plaza, Piazza del Campo, where there is a famous horse race. It's a nice place to see. If you haven't been there, you're invited to come. But the thing which is nice is that if you run out of ideas, what you do, you go down into the Piazza del Campo, you sit down, you get a glass of wine, and you can wait for better ideas. And I tell you, I had many of those sessions. And finally, the new ideas came when Craig Venter published the genome of Haemophilus influenzae. That was a new technology, was new information, something that nobody had seen before. So I thought maybe that could be a new way of approaching developing vaccines. So I went to visit Craig Venter and asked him whether he would be willing to sequence meningococcus B for us. I'll tell you, the first 5 minutes was not easy because he had done Haemophilus influenzae, was thinking Drosophila, was thinking to man, this was before Celera, and he could not see any reason why he should sequence another bacterium. But then I told him about the medical need, the importance of the disease, and the fact there were no other tools to solve this problem, and he actually agreed pretty quickly to sequence that genome for us. So we started this new collaboration where we sequenced the genome of meningococcus B, and we were trying to use that information to develop a vaccine. And basically, we called that reverse vaccinology. The idea was that since the Pasteur principles, where basically you start from the pathogen, did not work, we wanted to try an alternative approach where you don't start from growing the pathogen. You actually don't need to grow the pathogen. You start from the information on the genome, which is in the computer. And then you start to design from here a reverse path to go to the same thing. And the question was, is that doable? So while a tiger, Craig Venter, and later Claire Fraser sequenced the genome, while the sequence was incomplete, we were trying to understand the sequence and express proteins and do experiments. And very quickly, in less than 18 months, we got to a stage where we knew we did not know exactly what the vaccine was going to be, but we knew we were going to make it. And the reason was the following. We basically predicted that would be in the genome were approximately 600 proteins that were supposed to be on the surface, exposed, good targets for vaccines. We wanted to express them all, but the first pass we expressed them 350. And we didn't care about the others at the beginning. We purified 344, we immunized mice with 344 proteins. And very quickly, we got an idea of the power of the new technology. And that came when we realized that we had identified 91 proteins which are on the surface of meningococcus, possible targets for vaccination. You say, why 91 is so exciting? Well, it's so exciting because the entire scientific community up to that moment In all the decades I've been working on Neisseria, not only meningitis, but gonorrhea and lactamica, they've been identifying the entire literature, not more than 10, 15 proteins. That all was known about proteins on the surface. And now in a few months we got 91. So it was clear that we're getting a lot of new things. Even more interesting is that 28 of those were able to induce bactericidal antibodies. And for meningococcus, it's well known that if you get bactericidal antibodies with human complement, basically that response correlates with protection in humans. So this was very encouraging. So this part was very quick. In 18 months, we got from basically starting to talking about the genome to getting a lot of candidates. Then the rest, which was going from 28 proteins to the 5 that eventually ended up in the vaccine, prioritizing them, that took several years. Then doing the GMP, the things, that took still a long time. But eventually, we made a vaccine, and when we got a new vaccine, we asked the question, how does that compare to the only other vaccine that we have, the one which is made by automembrane vesicles? And so we put together a collection of strains from all over the world that will represent as much as we could the global population diversity. And then we ask how the new vaccines cover that panel of strain. And we found that the automembrane vesicle vaccine, in the best case, will cover 20%. Our vaccine, basic formulation, working on alum, covered 78%. And we knew that the antigens were good enough to cover also the rest, because if we add another adjuvant, like CPG, we'll go to 90%. Another adjuvant, MF59, will go to 95%. If you use the most powerful adjuvants known today, like Freund adjuvant, you go to 97%. So we knew that the antigens themselves were good enough to cover the entire population. So that was a good result to find. We decided to move into phase one, and that was the most difficult moment because other people had tried to use recombinant proteins, and they got before us, and they did get some results which are reasonably good in mice, but when they went to humans, they failed. So these data in mice were good, but were still scared about the response in humans. Fortunately, when we got to humans, we found these are three representative strains. Basically, the adults responded basically almost 100% against these strains. And then from adults, we moved into infants. And in infants, we got equally a good response, not 100%, but pretty, well, actually some strains are pretty close to 100%. And so we are now at the stage where this vaccine has gone through a phase two, and we are planning to start phase three quickly. So this is an example of a vaccine that basically could not be developed using the Pasteur's principles, needed another technology, but something which is possible to do today. And obviously, the interesting thing is that not only using this reverse vaccinology and genomics, we have been able to develop a new vaccine, but you also make beautiful scientific discoveries. I'll show you just one. One of the major proteins that is in our vaccine is we called GNA 1870. But in the meantime, other groups have been working on this protein that was totally unknown before we started to work on this. And a year ago, there were two papers describing that this protein binds human factor H, which is a regulatory component of our complement. The interesting thing, that only binds human factor H, does not bind mouse, does not bind rat. The consequence of this is that the bacterium, by binding human factor H, coats itself with this protein and is basically becomes resistant to the alternative pathway of complement. So this bacterium grows very well in human blood, and if you remove these proteins, it's dead in human blood. On the other hand, if you put this bacterium in rat blood, in mouse blood, rabbit blood, doesn't bind factor H and survives. And now you know why a century of microbiology has never been able to develop an animal model for these things. It just cannot grow in that blood. So I thought it was an interesting observation. It allows you to not only make a vaccine, but you start to understand the biology of this pathogen. And this example of using the genome was pioneered by in the meningococcus B, but obviously has been applied by us and by others to many other bacteria. And I have to say, we have used for group B streptococcus, group A streptococcus, pneumococcus, and several of the others. And so far, we got excellent results every single time. Not only we can make vaccines which are much more powerful than any of the vaccines described before, but also we make, so again, very interesting biological observations. And I will not go into detail, but I'll only show one that probably you're aware of, that working with group streptococcus, we found that one of the protective antigens was a portion of a component of the pilus of group streptococcus, and then we found out that the pili were present also in group A streptococcus, and they were also present in pneumococcus. Well, that was totally unknown up to 3 years ago when we discovered them. I mean, essential microbiology amidst the presence of pili and streptococci. And now you can see them. They're pretty long. They should never be missed. And it's only through the genomics that we're able to discover something which was so important for the pathogenesis of this bacteria. And again, these are very good components of vaccines. So we are making vaccines, and we are having fun discovering new things. Now, so this is the example of how new technology, especially genomics, can help you to develop new vaccines. Now, I'd like to pause a little bit and try to understand what we know, putting together all our experience in vaccines so far, and which are the gaps that we, in our knowledge, to moving forward for vaccines. So this slide basically tried to see in the past, we license vaccines. Where have we been successful? And basically, I put this depending on the type of immunity. And it's pretty clear that when antibodies are the mechanism of protection, we've been successful. We licensed many vaccines. When antibodies are still there, and there is some other mechanism, could be T cells or mucosal immunity, we still have been able to license some vaccines. Typical is the flu mist, the live attenuated influenza. This is a vaccine that basically is pretty lousy in inducing antibodies, but in an efficacy trial has been this vaccine, which induces lower antibodies, has been better than the killed vaccine, which was used as a comparator, which induced more antibodies. So here is an example where antibodies are probably important, but the additional protection you get with a live attenuated vaccine is not explained by antibodies only. So there is something else out there that we like to be, say, is a component of T cells, or maybe it's a mucosal component, but we don't know what it is, and we don't know how to measure it. And then there are other vaccines that we basically say they should work based on T cells, but those vaccines we don't have. So basically the success of vaccine development decreases a lot when you move from antibodies to T cells. There is another variable that is important in making vaccines, and this is the antigen variability. If you put success in vaccine development here again, you see that when the antigen doesn't change, you're pretty successful. When you get the antigen that changes every 10 years, you can still make vaccines. Typical example are pneumococcus. Pneumococcus Prevnar 7-valent was introduced more or less 10 years ago and covered 80% of the strains in this country. Now there are some emerging strains that are escaping this vaccine, but in the 10 years, it has been possible to develop another vaccine. Now there are 13-valent coming. So we can cope with this. meningococcus is a similar thing. I mean, when I started making the vaccine for the UK, was in the US, it was mainly C and B. By the time we licensed the vaccine in the UK, in the US was Y. So the C vaccine alone was not good enough. But here is something that since the antigen change with the periodicity every 10 years, you can have enough time to do the next generation vaccine. Then you have these pathogens. They change like influenza. They change their antigen surface every year. And then it's pretty tough to cope with that. We can still make a vaccine for influenza, but we have to make a new vaccine every year. And we know how tough it is. And then we have those guys, like typical HIV, that basically they change their antigens every day. And that, so far, is beyond the reach of our ability to develop a vaccine. So if you put these two variables together now, the antigen variability and the type of immunity in a new graph, basically you have antigen variability, type of immunity. And now you put together the vaccines, you see diphtheria, for which was developed in 19, vaccine was available in 1890, basically. You see up there. HIV, for which we are still struggling, is down there. And that makes sense. And if you ask the question, where are the vaccines all the vaccines have been licensed up to today? Well, in this graph, all the vaccines licensed today are up there. Is a small portion of the total area that could be covered by vaccines. But basically, the outlier here is flu mist, live attenuated influenza, which is a mucosal component. And you ask the question, how do you move in the rest of the area? Well, one thing that is clearly a way forward is reverse vaccinology or genomics. Basically, the reverse vaccinology provides us orders of magnitude more targets than we used to have. The meningococcus is an example. Before we started, there were 15 antigens. When we did the genome, there were 600 potential antigens. And that's true for most of the bacteria and parasites. You've been working with 15, 20, 40 antigens. But the genome provides you with thousands of antigens. So you can actually search the genome for those antigens that work with the principles of being already validated. That means no change or little change in antigen variability, antibodies or antibodies and something else, but not, you don't go down to pure T cells. And these things work because they will be using the principles which have been validated by centuries of vaccinology. So you can actually, this is a gold mine. Any bacterium, any parasite that you can work on, just do it. It's almost guaranteed you're going to get a good vaccine. So this is a gold mine that just needs to be mined. There are not enough resources there to do it. But if the more you do, the more you will get out. However, even this is not enough. There are still areas which are beyond this part, which is genomics. And the question is, how are we going to get there? How are we going to conquer those diseases which are beyond this area? And unfortunately, here we have a gap in knowledge. That's where our knowledge ends today. Here we need a kind of paradigm shift. Unless we get some new knowledge, it will be difficult to do it. How are we going to go in that direction? How are we going to move here? Well, there are several ways that I think we should be going. One is what I call structural vaccinology. I come back to that. The other one is novel adjuvants. And the other thing is to really understand how the immune system works. And we are making great progresses today, and see whether we can program the immune system to take care of this area where we cannot yet navigate. Adjuvants, a typical example is all the work we have been doing to try to make a vaccine for avian influenza. Clearly, developing an adjuvant is very tough. Not only because there are no adjuvants. I mean, you can find thousands of adjuvants in the literature. If you just search, people want to give you a new adjuvant. I mean, just too many. I mean, you cannot cope with them. The problem is that in a century of vaccine development, it's only alum that was licensed in the early 20s, and MF59, oil in water emulsion, which was licensed in Europe in the year 2000. Those are the only two licensed adjuvants. Why all this period nobody worked on an adjuvant? No, they did. They worked, they developed many adjuvants, but like most of adjuvants, they all work in mice, but they all fail in safety, more or less. And they do fail either in preclinical studies, in toxicology studies, in phase one, in phase two, some in phase three, and some post-licensure. So developing an adjuvant is not just finding another molecule is going to work. I mean, that's easy. But developing an adjuvant that is safe is very tough. The MF59, the one that we developed and licensed in Europe in the year 2000, is an oil in water emulsion, which is a droplet of water, of oil, squalene, with surrounded by water, and the water is kept onto the oil by two detergents. This adjuvant has been licensed in the year 2000, and as a part of a seasonal influenza, has now been given to more than 30 million doses in Europe. So now the kind of safety test has been largely passed, and the safety database which is there is very good. In addition, it has been tested in a number of other clinical trials. And the typical example of how adjuvants are essential is avian influenza. Basically, to make a long story short, if you vaccinate against avian influenza without an adjuvant, you get no response. With the adjuvant, you get an excellent response. Not only you get an excellent response, but you can spare the dose because you don't need 15 micrograms. You can go down to 3.75 micrograms. So that's the solution for me, as far as I'm concerned, for avian influenza. Use the appropriate and safe adjuvant, and you will be able to prevent the next pandemic influenza. What I've been saying is basically we started from classical conventional vaccinology, the Pasteur principles. We moved into genomics, reverse vaccinology, and now we're moving towards the future. And the future is novel adjuvants. It's very important. But also, we need to understand the structure of the epitopes we work with. And here I'm going to use as an example, and I don't know if it's real, but it's just an example, work from Peter Kwong in Gary Nebel's institute, where basically they've developed this crystal structure of the B12 epitope of HIV. This was the cover of a Nature issue some time ago, of a beautiful study. And basically what they showed is that they mapped the epitope recognized by this antibody B12, which is shown in red in these three pictures, and this epitope is common virtually to most HIV isolates. So, and this epitope, you can see it. It's pretty interesting. And the problem is that the immune system doesn't see it. And now, the question is, what kind of glasses is the immune system using that doesn't see this thing that we see very well? If we could teach the immune system to recognize this epitope, probably we could solve the problem of HIV. And how can we do that? I don't think we are there yet, but we need to understand why the structure which we see here is not seen by the immune system. How can we do that? I think we can do more of what Gary Nebel has pioneered, which is to do more structures. Today we have structures of protective epitopes of 4, 5, maybe 10 epitopes, too little to make a rational conclusion. But doing the structure of epitopes, immunosilent epitopes, immunodominant epitopes, today is possible. We could start a high-throughput, project, and maybe in a few years we could have hundreds of epitopes which are immunodominant, hundreds of epitopes which will be immunosilent. And maybe we'll start to understand the rules of how the immune system sees the structure. If we can understand that, then we can design. If we can design, we can probably solve HIV. Maybe we can solve universal influenza and many other things. So what I'd like to say is that 10 years ago, we started using genomes for vaccine development. Today, we do not start vaccine project without knowing the genome. What I would like to say is that in 10 years from now, we should not start a vaccine project unless we have all the structures in place. I think that's the next, adjuvants and structures, the next big challenge in vaccine development. The other gap in vaccine development is what I call structural gap. It's not a knowledge gap. We know that, what we should do. But, and the gap is that today in our vision, in our society, there's no mechanism to develop those vaccines that are not useful to the rich people. And by rich people, I mean the European, the Americans, and a few other countries. There are a lot of vaccines that are badly needed in developing countries, but that we don't need, and there's no economic incentive to do it. And that is the kind of frustration that has been always with me all these years. And I'm pretty happy to say that recently we set up an institute that's going to be non-profit and has a sole and unique goal to prioritize those projects that are needed only in developing countries. And also proud to say that we started we had an inauguration ceremony a few months ago, and that the new director comes from the NIH, is Alan Searle, that used to be to work in malaria here and is now there to work in these new things. With that, I think I'm coming to the end of my talk, and I first of all like to thank you for your attention, and I hope I gave you some ideas of how can we develop more vaccines in the future, but also how we could change our mindset, how we see vaccines. Vaccines will be an important, very important tool in the 21st century. In order to get the full advantage of that, we need to get away of the mindset of the 20th century. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rina. Before we open up the questions, I would like to, on behalf of the NIAID and the NIH, to present you with this token of our appreciation for your fine lecture.
Well, thank you. Well, this is fantastic.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions?
Groupy meningococcus. Yeah. The question is how we went down from the 60 or 90 proteins down to the 5 that eventually ended up in the vaccine. And that was a lot of hard work. Basically, we set a number of parameters. Immunogenicity, the titers of bactericidal antibodies induced, variability of the antigen presence. So we had to set up a collection of strains, global collection of strains, and see whether they were conserved, whether the gene was there, the amino acid sequence was there, the epitopes were there. So it was a long work. And we basically prioritized them in according to several of these criteria, and eventually we ended up with 5.
Yes.
That's a good question. You're asking, the question is, if I can paraphrase the question a little bit, adjuvants is, the world of adjuvants is a black box. How do you navigate in that black box? And how do you make decisions about MF59? Well, MF59 was developed in early 90s, actually late 80s. So was developed, at that time, oil and water emulsions were kind of trendy. Because we're a non-toxic version, if you like, of Freund. And so that was the only rationale which was there at that time. What we've done today is a lot more characterization. And what we know is that the way, today you can talk about two types of adjuvants. Those which are TLR dependent, those which are TLR independent. MF59 is clearly TLR independent. it works on what today will some people like to call inflammasome. So basically it turns on the kind of inflammatory cascade, but it's not enough to do side effects. And we've done an experiment where basically we try to understand in detail how it works. So we have been injecting the muscle, taking out the muscle, and do microarray at different times. And it's amazing. If you, in the last 10 years, there have been a lot of papers where people try to put adjuvants, including MF59, in vitro, with PBMCs, and you will try to find an explanation why these are such a powerful adjuvants. And you will find that, yes, you find a paper, you can publish, you see some effects on here and there and a lot of things. But those effects are so small that I never could think that those effects would explain the magnitude of immune response that you get. So when we did this microarray, then we got the answer. And the answer is that when you do microarrays in the muscle instead of the PBMCs, now the response in gene expression is huge. Got 900 genes that go either up and down. And don't go 1.5-fold, they go 10-fold. They're a really huge thing. And the interesting thing is that at the beginning is the muscle that is activated, and then with time you see new genes that come in are activated, and those are new cells that come in. So the dendritic cells and other cells that come into the muscle. At the end, what happens is that MF59 changed the basically recruits to the injection site a number of immunocompetent cells. So it creates almost an immunocompetent environment where the antigen presentation is optimal. So that's the way we see the things today. And there are all the cytokines go up and down, all everything. It's a lot of details we can discuss more if you like. The other thing is that using this technology, you can also look for safety things, because there are signs, for instance, if you get systemic reactions, you will see some genes that go up and down. So you can actually, now today we have the tools to start to put some light into this black box of adjuvants. The other ones are the TLR agonists, and those are pretty clear. They work through the TLRs, and they trigger a signal cascade. And the question is whether we can combine these two things to get an optimal response. Sorry, it was a little bit long, but. Yeah, I mean, the question is why T cells are more difficult. It's just a question of getting a license, or is more fundamental question about the biology? I think it's both. I mean, if you go to the FDA and you say, if you have influenza, if you reach those levels of antibodies, or the EMEA in Europe, you will get a license. But if you go there and you say you've got a good panel of T cells, interferon gamma, IL-2, all these kind of things, they'll say, come back when you know more. I mean, is that correct? I don't know, but I think the problem is that we don't know how to measure protective T cell responses. And the absence of knowledge, I think regulatory agencies are probably right to be conservative. How can you make a decision? I would not be in the position to say you got interferon gamma, then you get a license. Because I don't know what's in between. With antibodies, you do passive immunization, you know the answer. So I think that's one thing. And the other thing is that I think it's crystal clear that T cells play an extremely important role in immunity. It must be a good reason why our immune systems got both of them. but where they really play a big role is, one is obviously to have a good help, so you can get a lot of antibodies. And the other thing is that they do get important role after infection. Once the infection is there, then they take care of it. And that's pretty clear. But most of the vaccines we work with, we want to prevent them. So the question is that, are T cells important in prophylactic vaccines where you don't want to get infection? And that question, I don't know whether we understand the details of that. Yeah, the question is whether logistics are as important as developing new vaccines for developing countries. For instance, the cold chain. And clearly they are important. I've been looking into that. My reading is that the cold chain is important, but it's never the rate limiting factor. If you have a good vaccine and the political will to implement it, you will be able to set up a cold chain. It takes time, needs an effort, but can be done. What is never done is that phase that goes after the discovery research, the effort to transform the research into a product which is licensed. That part, nobody knows how to do it. Only companies do that kind of thing. And that part is what is the most important gap for me, that I think we can fill. With our knowledge for developing countries.
Yeah. So how far away are we from individual
That's a great question. How far away we are from individual personalized vaccination? And that's an interesting question, because when you go to therapy, it makes a lot of sense, because that with therapy, there are some therapies that are effective, so some people are sick will not be effective for others. So screening and good diagnostics make lots of sense. Vaccination, at least the way we see so far, most of the time we want to vaccinate everybody. The vaccines we are developing are vaccines that basically should target more than 90% of the population. And so the way we see vaccines today, you would not like to have an individual vaccination. But you would like to have vaccines that are effective despite the diversity of the individuals. So although personalized vaccination is trendy, I hope we don't go too much in that direction. On the other hand, you can still ask the question, what about that 5, 10% or 15% that do not respond? Today we have the power, the knowledge to understand those populations and predict that people will not be able to respond. So can we do something about that? And then the answer is yes. But hopefully that will be to address that 5, 10%. 15% of non-responders that we have in all the vaccines. That's my point of view.
Well, yeah?
I think that is also possible. I mean, eventually, I think if you go down to the path a few years from now, every person will be typed, if you like, at birth, and you will know the weakness of the things. Then you can decide that some people should get some vaccines, others should not, because of the risks of disease. I think for infectious disease, I don't know whether you can go in that direction too much, but for cancer, if you get to get cancer vaccines, I think that would make a lot of sense.
Any
If not, we have a reception outside for those of you who want to continue the conversation with Reno. Reno, thank you very much for a spectacular lecture.